From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, shock rocker Marilyn Manson. He used to be called a sissy, now he's called the Antichrist. His music has been condemned in Congress. Many cities have tried to ban his concerts. Is the boy misunderstood? We'll talk about his onstage persona and his formative years in Christian school. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography of Radcliffe Hall, the author of the 1928 lesbian novel The Well of Loneliness, a book that was banned in its own time. And it's Mardi Gras. Rock historian Ed Ward plays some music associated with the celebration. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was welcomed back to UN headquarters with applause today, but the Clinton administration is refraining from any kudos until officials get assurances on what they see as ambiguities and possible loopholes in the agreement on Iraqi weapons inspections. President Clinton says the United States wants to make sure Saddam Hussein lives up to the terms of the pact.
We have to be watching very closely now to see not just what Iraq says, but what it does. Not just the stated commitments, but the actual compliance. Let there be no doubt, we must remain committed to see that Saddam Hussein does not menace the world with weapons of mass destruction.
Mr. Clinton was speaking to the National Council of Jewish Women in Washington. In Kuwait City, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports there has been a further buildup of U.S. military forces in the Persian Gulf region.
Some 25,000 troops in all were posted to aircraft carriers and air bases as the standoff between Iraq and the UN built. Officers say that order has not changed, and plane loads of troops and equipment continue to arrive in Kuwait. An Army officer says they've been arriving nearly 1 hour and will continue at least until tomorrow. About 1,500 American troops are stationed in Kuwait permanently to enforce UN resolutions limiting Iraq's military activities. Some of their tours of duty have also been extended because of the recent crisis. Military officials credit their heavy presence here as a key factor in reaching the UN deal with Iraq. President Clinton has made clear there will be no military stand down until that deal is tested by actual weapons inspections. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Kuwait City.
The federal government has dropped all charges against the two men arrested last week for possessing what was believed to be lethal anthrax. Tests revealed the substance was only a benign form of anthrax used in vaccines. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports from Las Vegas.
The charges have been dropped against both former suspects, but only one of the men is free. William Job Levitt Jr., a Las Vegas area businessman and part-time medical researcher, had been released Saturday on his own recognizance. Notified on Monday afternoon that the charges against him had been dropped, he appeared on the courthouse steps to announce he had no hard feelings. The other former suspect, Larry Wayne Harris, heard a judge dismiss the charges in federal court. But he was immediately rearrested and returned to jail for allegedly violating his probation from a previous conviction. Last year, Harris pleaded guilty in Ohio to illegally obtaining 3 vials of bubonic plague germs. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 32 points at 8,378 in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite is down a fraction. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower today as the broader market retreats from its record highs. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
Much of the market's retreat is being led by drug issues, which are lower after British drug giants GlaxoWelcome and SmithKline-Beecham abruptly canceled their merger plans. There is also negative pressure coming from rising long-term interest rates, which are up after Fed Chairman Greenspan questioned whether the fallout of the Asian financial crisis will be sufficient to keep inflation in check. During the first day of his Humphrey Hawkins testimony to Congress, Greenspan said, unless demand in the U.S. softens or productivity growth accelerates even more, profit margins will be squeezed and inflation will eventually pick up. For a market expecting a discussion about deflation, Mr. Greenspan's remarks were a disappointment. I'm Doug Krisner.
Consumer prices were unchanged last month. It was the first time the consumer price index has not budged in 4 years, according to the Labor Department. Energy costs registered their biggest drop in nearly 7 years. GlaxoSmithKline and SmithKline are making explanations for their abrupt decision to call off a widely anticipated merger. Stock prices for both companies have plunged today. SmithKline says the decision was made because of what it called insurmountable differences in putting together what would have been the biggest corporate merger in history. A spokesman for Glaxo says the company is not actively looking for another merger partner. Attorneys for Oprah Winfrey have rested their case in the defamation lawsuit against her brought by Texas cattlemen. The cattlemen suing because of losses they sustained, losses they blame on remarks that Winfrey made on her television show. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the most controversial rock stars today, Marilyn Manson. Taking his name from Marilyn Monroe and Charles Manson, he adopted the onstage persona of the Antichrist. His clothes add to his transgressive image. One New York Times concert review described him as wearing an elastic back brace, a jockstrap over a G-string, sheer stockings, leather straps around his calves, and heavy-soled black shoes. For most of his teen and preteen fans, he embodies nonconformity and rebellion. But many parents aren't amused by the idea of their kids listening to songs with titles like Antichrist Superstar and Cake and Sodomy, not to mention the titles with expletives. They don't want their children seeing a performer who has exposed himself on stage. Attempts have been made to ban Marilyn Manson's concerts in cities around the country. Now he has a best-selling memoir written with music critic Neil Strauss, who writes for the New York Times and Rolling Stone. Before we talk with Marilyn Manson, let's hear one of his most popular records, The Beautiful People. I talked with Marilyn Manson about his performances and asked about one of the things he's known for on stage, tearing up Bibles.
The last album, Antichrist Superstar, was a lot about challenging modern conventions like Christianity, as well as politics, but also pointing out that rock and roll could be just as silly and blind. And so, in a lot of ways, I mocked myself and those around me. And part of the show included me coming out on stage with this mock fascist rally where I was assuming the role of kind of a preacher. And then I tore up a Bible. That's what that included.
You have to buy a lot of Bibles in order to do that.
No, I stole them all from hotel rooms, actually.
Did you really?
Yes.
There have been a lot of rumors circulating around you. I imagine that one of your favorites is that you had a rib removed so that you could perform fellatio on yourself. What do you make of these rumors? Do you have any idea how it started?
I have a feeling that one started because I often like to wear medical back braces and things around my waist, and I think someone thought that maybe that had something to do with an operation. That's the only way I could think of that rumor. Other than the fact that everybody probably wants to perform oral sex on themselves, and they were living vicariously through me.
Why do you wear like a back brace on stage? There's also a lot of like old medical illustrations in your book of the body.
I wore it for I enjoyed the way it looked and the way it felt. No real reason other than that. I've always had a fascination with medical apparatuses and prosthetic limbs and things of that nature. I guess because as a kid I was in hospitals a lot. I was pretty sickly growing up. And
what were you sick with?
I had pneumonia about 3 times. I also had several operations, and I was just kind of a, I guess, you know, a sickly kid. My father was in Vietnam, and he sprayed Agent Orange, and they've sent me to do a lot of medical testing as a kid to see if there were any adverse effects, but they never really found anything in particular. But we could always blame the government for why I am the way I am.
You know, I think that you went to a Christian school, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a boarding school?
No. My parents wanted me to get a better education because we weren't really wealthy or anything. Just kind of below middle class. And I guess in their attempt to try and give me something better, they wanted me to be, provided with an intellectual atmosphere. And they weren't aware of the religious baggage that came along with sending me to a private Christian school. So it was something that probably is most responsible for making me into the type of, artist that I am, because it made me see things and distrust things always because of the hypocrisy that I was witnessed as a kid.
Well, you know, you're so deep into, you know, Antichrist imagery in your shows, and it seems to me you really have to almost be from a pretty strict Christian background in order for Antichrist imagery to have that kind of power. I mean, for Satan and for satanic lyrics to have a lot of power, you have to come from a background that really believes.
Well, there's a lot of things that I tried to make in the show that was very beautiful in a lot of strange ways. And it was the character of Lucifer that I most identified with in literary terms when it comes to the Bible, because he was someone who was cast out of heaven because he wanted to be God. You know, he was the first rebel, the ultimate, going against the grain, I guess. And that's really my relationship when it comes to the Bible and you know, Satan and those type of characters. I'm not, you know, a lot of people will mistake me for a devil worshiper. I just happen to be very open-minded when it comes to religion, and I've studied a lot about many different religions, and I've found in the end the only thing you can really believe in is yourself. God and Satan are two words, just like Marilyn Manson, kind of like your left and your right hand. It kind of exists in everyone.
Do you think that Satan, to you when you were a kid, was the equivalent of, say, you know, James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, was to people in the 50s?
Not as a kid. As a kid, it was something I was very afraid of. And that was something that over the years in Christian school, I was told that the end of the world would come. And it, actually, in the Bible, when you study it, the word Antichrist doesn't really exist other than describe people that disbelieved in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. And the Antichrist mythology is something that Western Christianity has developed over the years as like the ultimate boogeyman to kind of terrify people into, you know, ultimately, you know, handing over their souls and their pocketbooks.
You said that as a kid, the idea of the devil or of the end of the world really terrified you. What was the imagery or the language or the ideas that you found particularly scary, the kind of thing that would give you nightmares?
Well, there was certain books and movies. I remember there was something called Thief in the Night, and it was about the rapture, which is also another Western Christian myth that doesn't really exist in the Bible. And this is the idea that, you know, one day unbeknownst to everyone, Jesus will come back, and all the people who are saved will disappear and go to heaven, and the rest of them will be left on earth to suffer, you know, under the reign of this Antichrist character. So this is something I was told over and over as a kid, and they had introduced different ideas, such as the UPC coding system was going to employ the mark of the beast, and you couldn't buy things at a grocery store unless you, you know, had denied Christ. And it was kind of overwhelming for being 12 years old, and I used to have terrifying nightmares about it. And finally, year after year, because they kept telling us that, you know, I guess inspired by George Orwell, they said that, you know, 1984 was going to be the end of the world, of course, everyone thought. And when that finally rolled around, I guess something in me snapped and realized that the end of the world wasn't going to happen. So I developed a chip on my shoulder, and I think that's why I had to become what I was afraid of. That's why I assumed the role of the villain that I feared most as a kid. And that was part of what Antichrist Superstar was about. It was kind of demystifying the whole Antichrist thing by becoming it for me. And also pointing out that sometimes villains are really no different than everyone else. They just excel in the characteristics that everyone has. And they're not afraid to admit it, that's all.
Now, how did your teachers deal with the popularity of heavy metal music and horror movies? Did they lecture you about that?
That's how I discovered all of my favorite bands, because they would have these seminars where they would play music backwards and show us pictures of, you know, all these different groups, Queen and Electric Light Orchestra and Black Sabbath and Kiss and things like this. And I immediately went out and bought the records.
Were you alone in doing that, or was that a popular way of finding out what bands would be interesting?
At Christian school, I was very much alone in doing that, and frowned upon by my friends because they were all burning rock albums at their little youth group rallies. Kind of in a very Nazi-esque way, which was something that just always didn't make sense to me, even when I was trying to fit into the idea of Christianity, I couldn't see destroying something, you know, any form of art, just as that being a very distasteful act. So I went on to make a business of heavy metal in some ways, because the other kids in my school who had started to catch on to it weren't allowed to go buy them, so I would go buy records and sell them back to the kids.
And, did you make a good living?
And eventually I would also steal them out of their lockers and then keep the records for myself after I sold it.
You moved from Christian school to public school. So suddenly
Yes.
The things that had really been taboo in Christian school were things that I imagine just about everybody was doing in public school, listening to heavy metal music, going to horror movies.
Right, but unfortunately I was considered the sissy from private school, and I was, you know, beaten daily for it. So I tried my best to fit in. I joined a band, but I got stuck playing the cymbal and the triangle and a bunch of instruments that aren't really great for building your confidence.
And the Antichrist on cymbal.
Exactly.
Oh, well, you know, in your book you describe yourself as a sissy then, and you say, quote, "No one wanted to make friends with a squirrely, long-haired guy with a rash-covered neck poking out of his Judas Priest jersey." I thought that was a really funny description. So, I mean, did you try to look like a real heavy metal guy in a way to cover up looking like a sissy, you know?
I don't know if it was that conscious. You know, I wanted to identify with someone, and it seemed like people that were really into music were a lot less judgmental than your average football player or, you know, scholar, I guess. So I turned to music was always my escape.
My guest is Marilyn Manson. He has a new memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is Marilyn Manson, and he has a new memoir now. Let's talk about some of the other things that helped form you. Like in your memoir, the very beginning of the book starts off in your grandfather's cellar, where your grandfather kept kinky sex magazines and sex appliances, and you say that that cellar just scared the heck out of you as a kid. You thought that that cellar was hell.
Well, it was a little bit more than just kinky. It was some really bizarre stuff that he had, you know, animal pornography and stuff, you know, to have as a first impression of pornography was a little awkward. It wasn't like Playboy or Penthouse. It was a little bit more extreme than that. So I became really kind of fascinated with him because he was kind of like an oddity to me, a monster, because he didn't speak, because he had throat cancer. And I started spying on him because I was very fascinated. And it's strange looking back now. I find that I have a lot in common with him because the rest of the world sees me the way that I saw him. And so now I think I understand him a little bit more than when I was 12.
But of course, I think for you it's an act, right? Yes?
Well, I'm not particularly interested in pornography exactly, but the way that I relate to him is on the level that he had, you know, his personal likes that other people might not agree with. And that's how I relate to him, that I have a certain way of thinking that some people wouldn't agree with.
Now, what do you think your early exposure to these really perverse sex magazines had on you?
I suppose that it just made me more scared of sex, but fascinated with it in different ways than probably most of my friends were at the time. Kind of obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
But
with having it or with thinking about it?
Both. Not just in the pursuit. It led to me having a lot of really strange nightmares because we used to take the pictures and we would cut out just the private parts in the pictures. And I started having really disturbing nightmares at an early age about that it being cutting up people for real. And it was something that started to really make me, I guess, a little bit strange to my friends. But it was something that I eventually grew out of. But now I have a real dislike for pornography, I think.
Now, you mentioned that your father was in Vietnam, and he was one of the people who sprayed Agent Orange, the herbicide, across the country, and that you and he had to get regular checkups to see if there were any permanent damaging effects from mm-hmm. the herbicides. Did that add to your feelings about being different? I mean, you know, doctors had to check you ever so often to see if you were normal or not.
Yeah, I felt like I could never really do things that normal kids could do because something was going to go wrong or I was going to be allergic to something. And my mother always kind of treated me like a mama's boy, that I couldn't, you know, I guess I just really couldn't do the things that other kids did because she scared me into thinking that I would get sick or I would be allergic to something, basically. Because there was that unknown idea that there might be something wrong with me that we hadn't discovered yet.
Marilyn Manson is my guest, and he has a new memoir. You started off not by performing music, but by writing poems and short stories. Tried to get them published and didn't. Then you ended up doing open mic things and did readings, which I think eventually turned into more of a performance art. And I guess it's during that period that you adapted the Marilyn Manson persona. Can you talk a little bit about the early days of Marilyn Manson, the early days of that persona, how you got the name, who you saw that character as being early on?
At the time, I was spending most of my free hours watching talk shows and public television, kind of studying the phenomenon that would grow to be how television's culture is right now, and the the way that people are brought onto TV to hurt each other on shows like Jerry Springer and Ricky Lake, Jenny Jones, and things like that. And it was just interesting to me how America was creating its icons and how it always has, even with someone like Jesse James, who was a murderer, but kind of elevated to a folk hero. And I think the same thing, you know, has happened with you know, someone like Charles Manson, and then at the same time how you know, tragedy is exploited, and someone like Marilyn Monroe, you know, through death becomes such an icon. And I thought putting the two of those together had something really important to say about American pop culture and the way stars are made. And it also represented what I was feeling at the time as far as my own personality went, the dichotomy between beauty and ugliness, good and evil, that I wasn't gonna pick one or the other, that I liked.
Can I add a dichotomy? Can I add a dichotomy here? Sissy and Antichrist. Wimp and Antichrist.
Absolutely right.
So the Marilyn Manson name is also a mixing of gender. What was that about for you?
You know, maybe that was something that I had taken along with me from my grandfather's secret cross-dressing that I had discovered. I think that I've always been, I remember as a kid, other people would always say to my mom, "Oh, you have a lovely daughter," because I was always kind of feminine looking at an early age. But I guess I realized, instead of trying to fight it and trying to fit in or be tougher or whatever it was going to be, that I would create my own standards, and not only with the way I looked, but with the way I thought. And I would try and express that through art, and music is what I picked.
Marilyn Manson, he has a new memoir called The Road Out of Hell. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from Walker & Company, publisher of Fermat's Enigma, the epic quest to solve the world's greatest mathematical problem by Simon Singh. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, some New Orleans music for Mardi Gras from rock historian Ed Ward. Book critic Maureen Carrigan tells us about a new biography of Radcliffe Hall, the British writer whose 1928 novel about a lesbian couple, The Well of Loneliness, was the subject of obscenity trials. And we continue our conversation with Marilyn Manson.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Marilyn Manson. The controversial rock star has a new memoir that explains how he developed his outrageous persona. His teenaged and preteen fans see him as a symbol of rebellion, but many of their parents object to his onstage antics and to the lyrics of his songs, which they interpret as anti-Christian and obscene. Now, in a couple of your CDs, you actually have lyrics reprinted in the liner notes. I'm wondering if you think that your listeners would be able to understand the lyrics if it wasn't for the fact that they were printed.
It's possible.
I ask that only because, you know, like, some people have made so much of what the lyrics say. They've been quoted in congressional meetings. They've been quoted in, you know, by religious groups. They've been quoted by groups who are angry at record companies that release your music and so on.
Right.
But you know, really, you sing with a very kind of deep, growly voice, and it's kind of difficult to make out the lyrics.
Well, the lyrics are very important to the overall picture, so I've always wanted them to be understood. And the last few records that I've done have been, I guess, more aggressive and abrasive than probably some of the stuff that I'll be doing in the future. So I think it's always a matter of there's a different way of expressing different feelings, and the way that I felt on the last album was very aggressive, so sonically. And, you know, lyrically, it was presented that way. And I think in the future, the stuff that I have to do is a little bit more a different emotion. And I think that'll be something that people will be surprised by, I think.
Can you tell us more about the surprising direction you're heading in?
Well, it's more about after going through what I just did, you know, in the past 2 years, it's almost like a Edward Scissorhands or E.T. or someone who feels like they're in a place where they're not accepted and don't belong. And oftentimes something that is different and you don't understand, like a spider, you want to kill it immediately. And it's more from that perspective. It's much more vulnerable music that I'm making on this new album. And, you know, both sonically and lyrically, it's more about the depression of alienation rather than the aggressiveness of it. It's about the emptiness of it.
What's behind the change?
I think writing a book really transforms a person and makes you think about things differently. So, and I don't want to repeat myself. I think that's boring for me and for anyone who's listening. So, I think I've spent a long time talking about my views on religion. There's not really much more I can say. So I think there's a lot other interesting things to talk about in music.
Let me quote some of the remarks made about your music by people who have seriously objected to it. C. Dolores Tucker, who's one of the people who has organized against gangster rap, called one of your albums the dirtiest, nastiest porno record directed at youth that has ever hit the market. Senator Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat from Connecticut, called you perhaps the sickest artist ever promoted by a mainstream record company. The mayor of West Palm Beach said, Marilyn Manson is clearly bent on degrading women, religion, and decency while promoting satanic worship, child abuse, suicide, and drug abuse. Pat Robertson said, Manson incites people to murder, to rape. What's your reaction to these reactions?
I think a lot of them are hysterical and silly. I think it's easier for someone to point out who's bad to make themselves look better. And all of those people are all in positions where they've used scapegoats to better their political careers. I'm not going to disagree and say that the music that I do is, you know, Air Supply or something like that, but I don't think it's any more offensive than the world that's around us. I think it also has a value to it. It's not senseless and pornographic. I think it has a lot of important things to say and quite literary at times.
Do you ever have any reservations about the image that you put forth to young people? Do you ever wonder if maybe at the very least it gets kids to think that being self-destructive is really hip?
No, I think that that's always a part of puberty, always a part of finding yourself.
Being self-destructive?
Yeah, I haven't invented self-destruction. I think, you know, I've learned it from growing up, as anyone would. I have, however, tried to prove to kids that, you know, through that self-destructive phase can come a stronger person. So it's never senseless nihilism. There is always something hopeful, I think, in the end.
You've had concerts canceled in several states because, you know, the city council or the state government has ruled that you just can't perform in any city-owned or state-owned places. Uh-huh. What impact has that had on your career? I mean, it's in some ways it's great publicity.
It is, but it's been real tedious and it's been a nuisance. And in most cases, for example, we would go to a city and 50 uniformed police officers would show up and they would come to me and they would say, you know, if these things that they're saying are true happen on stage, you're going to be arrested. I would go and do my performance. The crowd would enjoy it. I would enjoy it. Nothing illegal took place. The cops would come up to me afterward and shake my hands and say they had a great time. And that was pretty much the way the whole tour went. It's funny that all of these sick, disturbed ideas that these fundamentalist groups were spreading these rumors about, things that they said I was doing, it's funny that they were the ones who imagined them. So it's interesting that they had these sick ideas in their head. It wasn't something that I created.
What were some of the rumors that they were spreading about things that happened in your performances?
Well, they had a lot of really ridiculous things that I would bring a cage full of children and lowered into the crowd, and they'd be beaten by the rest of the crowd. They said that I had special agents called the Santa Clauses who would pass out narcotics to the audience. Just a bunch of silly things that it was... Even if they were true, obviously I would be in prison for it. So just on that simplest level, people should have had the common sense to know that they were false. But these things just went on, and because it was on the internet, people believed it, which is really strange and dangerous. That I think in the wrong hands, the internet can be a very dangerous tool. It's kind of the CB radio of the 90s, but it's being interpreted as a legitimate source of news, which it's not. And I think eventually there'll be some sort of laws that will deal with it.
What's the most like explicit sexual thing you've ever done on stage?
I think the most explicit thing that I've ever done that's, you know, fueled all of the rumors that I perform sex on stage all the time is there was one event where someone ran on stage to pull a prank on me, and they were nude. So instead of being made a fool of by them, I grabbed them and sort of, I guess you could say, performed oral sex on them. But that was more of a prank.
So this was a man who ran on stage naked?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And you think that helped get a lot of even more extreme rumors started?
I wouldn't doubt it. I think that's definitely where most of those came from. But, you know, that was something that happened probably 3 or 4 years ago. And it's been made out that it's something that I do every night on stage, which isn't true at all.
I think some people aren't really sure whether... in your performances, you're commenting on fascism or promoting fascism. So tell me a little bit.
Well, that's the complications of the statement in itself, and that's usually my aim, is to make people think. It's always been my favorite part of the show because...
Well, describe that part of the show.
It's what I talked about earlier when I come out on stage with this symbol for Antichrist Superstar, which is also... the symbol you find on all electrical equipment. It's a lightning bolt, and it means shock hazard. And I thought it was kind of sardonic because people consider me to be so shocking. So in the performance, I I make fun of in a, I guess, a dark sense, a dark sarcastic way, religious leaders, political leaders. And it's a bit of a fascist rally that's kind of making fun of that and pointing out the similarities. At the same time, it's also pointing out the similarities between, you know, even sporting events and definitely rock and roll as well. And all of that together is the statement for me. It's not only because people say, well, do you think your fans get it when they're cheering along with you, or are they just supporting what you're condemning? But I think it's very complicated, because it's all of that together is the statement that I'm trying to make. Mm-hmm. It's one big piece of performance. You know, I think it's quite clear that I'm not promoting fascism, because it goes against everything that I represent, which is individuality. But I am pointing out that rock and roll can be just as blind as religion.
I'm wondering if you have any empathy for parents who don't want their 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds listening to lyrics with references to sodomy and four-letter words. And
absolutely. You know, that's part of being a parent, I think. You know, if they don't want their kids to listen to something, then they shouldn't. You know, I have no objection to that. I don't think it's my place to tell parents, you know, what their kids can and cannot do. I'm trying to entertain people, and, you know, they can decide if their kid's smart enough to enjoy it or not. Just like they have to decide if their kid's smart enough to read Shakespeare or the Bible or watch CNN, you know, or any of that.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right.
Marilyn Manson has a new memoir called The Road Out of Hell. It's co-written with music critic Neil Strauss. Coming up, a new biography of the author of a now classic lesbian novel. This is Fresh Air. Radcliffe Hall's 1928 novel, The Well of Loneliness, has been called the lesbian novel. But the woman who took lesbianism out of the literary closet in the early 20th century has herself been obscured by the self-serving stories and biographies her lovers wrote about her. A new biography by Sally Klein, called Radcliffe Hall, A Woman Called John, attempts to put Hall in her rightful place as an early 20th century new woman and as a writer. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
A colleague stuck his head into my office the other day and asked me what I was reading. A new biography of Radcliffe Hall, I told him. Ooh, Radcliffe Hall, he chortled. Lucky for her, she was a lesbian. I offer that anecdote to everyone who assumes political correctness has muzzled the academy, and to those whose memories need a little jogging about who exactly Radcliffe Hall was. The author of the groundbreaking bestseller, The Well of Loneliness, Hall became a legend in her own time because of the obscenity trials concerning that book. She also generated scandalous gossip for her eccentric, mannish costumes and her out relationships with other prominent women. My imprudent colleague is right about Hall. had she been heterosexual, her reputation would now be wasting away on the modern novel compost heap, along with those of other traditionalists like Arnold Bennett and John Galsworthy. Even Virginia Woolf, who volunteered to testify against the banning of the Well of Loneliness in Britain, privately wrote to a friend that the dullness of the novel is such that any indecency may lurk there. One simply can't keep one's eyes on the page. You can tell that it pains Hall's latest biographer, Sally Klein, to have to record such criticisms. She's such a partisan that she even likes some of Hall's Hearts and Flowers poetry. Klein's biography, called Radcliffe Hall, A Woman Called John, is, like its subject, an extreme piece of work. If you don't already think that Radcliffe Hall is an even more underrated writer than, say, James Michener, by the time you finish this biography, you just might. Fortunately, Klein devotes generous space throughout her book, not only to bumping up Hall's literary ratings, but also to recounting her adventurous life and establishing her crucial place in the 20th century history of sexuality. Born in 1880 to an upper-class British couple who christened her Marguerite, Hall grew up a sickly tomboy. She was unappreciated by her frilly mother and probably sexually abused by her stepfather in an attempt to normalize her. Eventually liberated by a family inheritance, Hall began to publish verse and develop her signature style of dress, which included a cravat, fedora, monocle, and cropped hair with extravagant spit curls that resembled sideburns. She also converted to Catholicism and began openly living with Mabel Batten, a married woman and professional singer who renamed Hall John. When she was 48, Hall, who had by then established herself as a popular novelist, published The Well of Loneliness about a woman named Stephen Gordon, an invert of the masculine type. All hell broke loose. A London paper, the Sunday Express, condemned Hall's representation of lesbianism as biologically determined and said the novel forces upon our society the disagreeable task of cleansing itself from the leprosy of these lepers. In obscenity trials in England and America, the book was championed by the likes of E.M. Forster, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Edna Ferber, T.S. Eliot, Vera Brittain, and even the South Wales Miners Association. The Well of Loneliness catapulted Hall into that melancholy pantheon of one-hit writers, along with folks like Bram Stoker and Harriet Beecher Stowe, who actually spewed out lots of books but are known for one title alone. Klein thinks that The Well of Loneliness turned out to be a kind of literary curse for Hall because it erroneously categorized her as a lesbian polemical writer when, in fact, she was an artist with a capital A. I don't think Klein is going to win many converts to that view. Instead, what her ardent, exhaustive lump of a biography ironically demonstrates is that Hall's life was more rollicking, courageous, and erotically fulfilled than any story she ever committed to print.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, Mardi Gras music. This is Fresh Air. There are Lenten carnivals in Rio and Cologne, in Trinidad. offering blowout celebrations before the austerities of the pre-Easter season. But none is as famous as Mardi Gras. Because of the elaborate social events surrounding it, the one in New Orleans is perhaps the most famous. But in fact, Mardi Gras is celebrated throughout Louisiana on the Tuesday before Ash Wednesday.
Nothing could be more different than the Mardi Gras in New Orleans and the one that's celebrated in the Cajun country across the Atchafalaya Basin to the west. A Cajun Mardi Gras is definitely a glimpse into a pre-Christian past. Central to the Cajun celebration is the courir, in which masked riders wearing conical hats mount horses and ride to farms in the surrounding countryside. Once there, they dismount, dance to the Mardi Gras song, and pretend to rob the farmer of some rice, a chicken, some sausage, or something else that can be cooked into the gumbo, which the women of the community are cooking back in the town. For all its archaic splendor, though, the Cajun Mardi Gras is pretty one-dimensional, musically speaking. There's that one song, which the riders hear all day. For musical variety at Mardi Gras time, we have to turn to New Orleans, with its parades, its crews, and its huge crowds. Armstrong's King of the Zulus is the first Mardi Gras theme record I know of, recorded in 1926, 21 years before Armstrong was actually selected to head the city's largest black crew in 1947. But in recent years, thanks in large part to filmmaker Les Blank, attention has turned to another odder black Mardi Gras celebration. Always for Pleasure focused on the Mardi Gras Indians, black social groups who put on elaborate costumes and engage in ritual war, usually these days of a ceremonial nature, during the festivities. His film made one tribe, the Wild Chapatulas, famous, not least because it was the tribe to which the Neville family, New Orleans rhythm and blues royalty, belonged. But the other tribes are no slouches either. Still, there's no denying that the Nevilles have a long history of Mardi Gras music behind them. back in 1954 as the Hawkettes. They made a record that's been a long-time favorite at Carnival.
Down in New Orleans where the blues were born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On the side in Rampart Street, the combos play with the mambo beat. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo. Down in New Orleans.
And Mardi Gras mambo is a newcomer next to the song that's probably the celebration's real theme song.
While you go to New Orleans, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. If you go to New Orleans, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. When you see the Mardi Gras, somebody'll tell you what's Carnival for.
Professor Longhair first recorded Go to the Mardi Gras in 1949, and Fats Domino got his version out in time for the 1953 Carnival. But Longhair, with his wild Latin-flavored rhythms, was the song's definitive performer. Much of the music played in New Orleans during Mardi Gras is the classics, When the Saints Go Marching In, Little Eliza Jane, and the rest. But the music of the Indians is what showed up on the radio.
I go, I go, I go, I go one day. Chaco mo filo andande, chaco mo fila le well.
Larry Williams' boisterous rendition of One Indian Chant isn't as well known as the 1965 record by the Dixie Cups, but it's just one of a half dozen versions of the song that have been recorded since 1952. New Orleans carnival music has captured the national imagination, so if you're planning a Mardi Gras celebration, a trip to your local record shop should provide you with the sounds you need. The gumbo and other trappings, though, are strictly up to you.
Ed Ward is a music writer living in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.